Welcome to The Great Humbling. I'm Dougal Tyne, co-founder of the Dog Mountain Project and A School Called Home. In the spring of 2020, I began recording these conversations with the poet and recovering sustainability consultant, Ed Gillespie. We call them The Great Humbling because this feels like a time of being humbled, brought down to earth and, if we're lucky, back into connection with land and soil and with each other. Thank you for listening.
All right, here we are, episode 6. And for the first time in however many episodes it is that we've been doing this, we are not recording on Skype. I have this sense of being like, you know, the last people to leave Skype, please switch off the light. It may have been us. But somehow we have done all of these episodes of The Great Humbling with this rather retro technology. But the plugin that I was using to do multi-track recording just stopped working. And the much more expensive thing by the same people that we tried to use instead kept recording my voice with these ridiculously distorted levels, which may have been audible in recent episodes, despite all of the good work of our wonderful producer, David. So here we are on another platform. And
I can't even remember why we started using Skype in the first place. It must be because our first conversation was sort of just pre-pandemic, you know, before the arrival of Zoom and Teams and everything else. So we were probably still wedded to some arcane technology, and we've just stuck with it. I went down a rabbit hole. I was thinking about this and sort of reflecting on it, because way back when I first moved to London in the late 90s, you know, I was doing my master's in leadership for sustainability with Forum for the Future, and they issued us with pages so we could contact each other. And, the, you know, in 1997, the pager felt like space age tech. But apparently people still use pagers loads because the batteries go on forever. You know, they're really robust. And because they use FM, they don't use Wi-Fi. They use the FM radio frequency. So even if you're miles away from a decent signal, you can still get paged. So apparently folks still use them. Who knew?
Somebody was telling me the other day about a kind of a mesh, like low-level internet network using radio that sounds like it fits right in within the sort of how we make good ruins side of the stuff that I've been working on. So I have to check that out properly and tell you more about it on the next episode. But carry on. You've been checking out more. You've been thinking more about old technologies, haven't you?
Well, yeah, I just did a little bit of digging because I've still got an old dial-up phone at home for my landline, which I have for babysitting reasons, because my aunt, who sometimes does babysitting for me, doesn't have a mobile. So I need to be able to call the house. So I've still got, you know, a proper old type of phone, which I love. Apparently there's still some NATO warships which are running some of their software on Windows XP, which was launched in 2001. So how about that for cutting edge technology? Apparently they refer to it jokingly as Windows Submarine, because part of the UK nuclear fleet is still running on this sort of arcane platform. But yeah, it was making me laugh the other night because my nephew, my 18-year-old nephew, was over for dinner. And we were having a conversation about life choices and things that you do. And he's obviously at that wonderful crossroads of 18, not quite knowing where to go. And he was asking me what I was doing at 18. I said, well, I worked on my girlfriend's, at the time's, father's farm locally in Norfolk, who at the end of the summer said to me, he goes, if I hadn't paid you a penny, Ed, I'd have broken about even, because I broke so much agricultural equipment over the space of a few short weeks. I was obviously a massive liability. But I remembered a story where I was driving a bale trailer, picking up big round straw bales from the fields. And this baler trailer had a kind of fork-like boom, which would come out the side. and send a prong either side of the round bale to flick it onto the back of the trailer, and then a ram would push it to the back so you could get four round bales in a line. Anyway, this was all done by hydraulics, and the hydraulics were a bit leaky. So this boom was held up by a piece of rusty chain, which then snapped. And so as I was driving along down some tiny rural Norfolk back road, this boom swung out progressively and then hit a telegraph pole. completely snapped the telegraph pole in half, leaving me with, cables draped all over the tractor cab. And a terrified old lady who was walking her dog further up the lane, just looking at me in horror. But then I got out, obviously, and thought, now what do I do? So I walked to the local pub, which wasn't open. I mean, it was early in the morning. Knocked on the door, asked politely if I could use their phone to call the farm. And of course, I'd taken out the telegraph pole, so their phone didn't work. And then I had to walk to the next village in order to find somewhere which was still in connection with the network that I would just single-handedly taken out locally. But it just made me laugh about, the paralysis of those good old days where suddenly you're like, what did you do when you stuffed up like that? You had to go really, really analog.
Oh, well, yes. It's making me think of something that I heard Tyson Junker Porter say when he was on Gordon White's Rune Soup. And Tyson was like, look, from where I'm standing, it looks like there's some really weird ways of thinking that go on in this kind of white colonial mentality where it seems so logical to you guys that you want to take like the oldest and most essential thing, like growing food, and you want to put it onto the blockchain, the newest thing that doesn't even work yet and might not be here in another 5 minutes. And it's like... Even the ability to stand up and make proposals like, yeah, we're going to revolutionize the world food system by putting it onto the blockchain. The ability to stand up and say that with a straight face and not get laughed at is one of the signs of how lingering the kind of neophilia, the kind of valorization of anything that's new as better is still within the ruins of our kind of culture that was built around the logic of progress.
Totally. Well, speaking of neophilia, you've got a bit of a new look. I noticed that you've obviously been to the big city because you have a very neatly trimmed beard and a new, very, very fetching new haircut. But how was Gothenburg? How was your trip across to the west coast of Sweden?
Yeah, Gothenburg was good. It wasn't quite as star-studded as that visit of yours that you told us about in the last episode, but it reminded me how much I like Gothenburg, actually. And it reminded me that in my first 5 years or so living in Sweden, I used to be there two or three times a year for one reason or another. I just kept seeming to get interesting invitations there and find interesting people to collaborate with. And somewhere along the way, even before the pandemic, I think I'd kind of just fallen out of my set of connections and habits of being there. It was really nice to be there again because it's, that thing of how different cities have very different characters, different personalities and atmospheres. And I mean, Stockholm's a capital city. It's a very beautiful city. It's a bit cold. It's a bit, strangers don't smile at you very often in Stockholm. And that's what I noticed in Gothenburg. Even though it's a big city, it's also, it's got that kind of friendliness that you might associate with some of the northern cities in England or, places further west, Bristol, whatever. But just that kind of...
And east. Norwich is okay.
Norwich is okay, yeah. I don't think of Norwich as... I don't think of Norwich as a big city, but I'd never been to Norwich before our live episode last year. So what do I know? But yeah, so I was in Gothenburg and I did a bunch of different events and conversations. I recorded a 90-minute podcast in Swedish with these two priests from the Church of Sweden all about like their kind of theological reading of At Work in the Ruins and like how much of it connected for them in all of these ways. And it was really fascinating and it made me reflect on some of the paradoxes of operating in a language that isn't your home language, and that it's easier for me to have conversations about really big things in Swedish. It's not just because I have like a professional vocabulary around things that I write and talk about. It's more that when you talk about stuff that's that big, anywhere you have to talk in images, you have to make language do strange things. And in that situation, like the weirdness of the way that I speak Swedish compared to somebody who grew up here can actually be an asset, because I can bring strange images, strange turns of phrase to the table, and that can all feed the conversation we're having. Whereas in the situation where I just can't think of the word for light switch, there is no additional gift that I am bringing through my foreignness. I'm just encountering the limits of my vocabulary and or retention. And so I came back from Gothenburg going, okay.
You just stick the English word in when that happens.
Or point, or like try and describe it whilst people frown until they get the really obvious thing that I'm struggling to describe. There are multiple strategies. But no, I came back from Gothenburg and I went, okay, I need to just listen to more books in Swedish, like more Swedish audiobooks this year, and just generally make sure that I'm exposing myself to the stuff that builds my vocabulary further, because I've been here 12 years, you know, barring surprises, this is where I expect to live out my days. And I have to sort of, I have to surrender to the reality of operating in the language of the country that I'm in, even in the kind of public being on stage in front of a room full of people way, which is the thing that I've been most reserved about doing up to now. But I tell you, the other thing that's happened that's quite fun, I don't know if we've talked about this before, but a few years back, I translated from Swedish to English a novel by my friend Jesper Vates. It's a very good novel, and in English we call it Anything That Isn't Growing. And I translated it partly because it was one of the very few sort of pieces of realist climate fiction, if you like not something set in a sort of more sci-fi kind of future scenario. It's kind of set in a near future, but that's not the point of it. One of the few things like that that has ever really, really worked for me. And I mean, there are other examples. I think I've probably talked about Amitav Ghosh's Gun Island, and there's a novel by an American author whose name I'm going to remember in a minute, but the novel is called A Children's Bible, and she does a really great job in that. But Jesper's book was one of the handful of books that have really done it for me in that way. I translated it and he got a bit of funding to do that, but we never actually had a publisher on board for it. So this translation has kind of sat around in my drawer or just circulated here and there where we've had people to share it with. And I wrote something about it a couple of weeks ago. And I've heard from a publisher in Australia that are interested in it. So they're reading it at the moment. We shall see if it comes to anything. But it was a very nice start to the year to take the fruit of work that was done a few years back and go, actually, maybe its time has come to go out into the world. So watch this space. We'll see if there's more to report on that. Translating that book was sort of the closest that I was ever likely to come to writing a novel, because I realized by my late 20s that that wasn't where my gifts lay or what I'm most excited about as a writer. But meanwhile, something else is going on, which may also never see the light of day. But Alfie, aged 8, said to me very decisively on the way to school a week or two ago, your next book should be a children's book. And I said, oh, it's funny, you're not the only person who said that to me. And I said to him, well, how about we write a book together? And to my surprise, he completely full on, got the bit between his teeth. And it's now become a project. And on Sunday mornings, while Anna has a lie-in, me and Alfie are down here in the shoe shop. And we started out sort of drawing the world and some of the characters of this book. And then last Sunday, we wrote the first chapter of it. And he's really keen to carry on with it. I don't think Alfie and I are about to emerge as as the next J.K. Rowling or anything. But just the sheer pleasure of the kind of improvisatory quality of writing fiction in this zone of unexpected father and son collaboration has been one of the joys of this year so far.
Is it hyper-realist? Is it fantasy? Is it sci-fi? What is it? You don't have to give us a title or anything else, but just what genre does it fit into?
It starts with two creatures coming through the window of this boy's bedroom, and they were trying to get to the outside, but they fell in instead. And so then by the end of the first chapter, they're taking, due to some misunderstandings, they're taking him off to the outside. So it's some kind of fantasy. Oh, while we're talking about children's literature, I have to make an appeal to our readers, because I mentioned some time back that we've been reading Helen Cresswell's Bagthorpe Saga, the Bagthorpe Saga, written between the early 70s, and I think the last novel was written in 2001. 10 novels of this kind of very dark, funny, it's written in this hilarious sort of high style. I read, someone wrote an article about, sort of in tribute to these books, where she said, you know, it was a preparation for the mock heroic, such that not only did she know what she was seeing when she got to university and read Alexander Pope's The Rape of the Lock, but actually by comparison to the Bagthorpes, it was a bit disappointing. So it's, there certainly is a cult following of those of us who rate this as a major epic work of late 20th century literature. But there is a problem, which is that the 10th book, it's not just out of print. I cannot find it anywhere online. And I've managed to secure copies of the first 9, 7 of which are out of print. And to get the 8th book, I had to pay certainly more than I've ever paid for a paperback book. I found it on the Oxfam Bookshop website, and I thought, if I'm going to pay this much for a secondhand paperback, then at least I can be buying it from Oxfam rather than a collector or whatever. But this is an appeal to anybody. If you vaguely even think that you might have a copy of Bagthorpe's Battered from 2001, published by Faber and Faber, sitting around on your shelves, I'm willing to pay the same amount that I donated to Oxfam for the 8th book to a charity of your choice, or even to yourself, if that's where charity begins. But have a look, Bagthorpe's Battered. You would make an 8-year-old boy and his father very happy.
It's amazing. I've actually raised an eyebrow the other day about how expensive, you know, out of print books can be when you try and track them down. You realise, obviously, that's probably the bread and butter for, you know, the wonderful booksellers that are able to bring these copies or unearth them out and share them with folk. But I was trying to track down, following our discussion, Robert Anton Wilson's, you know, the Illuminatus trilogy. And actually, that's really hard to get hold of, you know, anything like what I might consider a reasonable price. So yeah, I don't think I'm going to get round to reading them, unfortunately. And people have said that, you know, they're not actually that great. So I'm not going to kind of part with hundreds of pounds.
I do have them as an ebook, and I think I got halfway through the first volume about 10 years ago. But yes, I can understand how it was that Bill Drummond had not actually managed to finish the Illuminatus trilogy, and only discover after he had lived out various events from it that that was the script that he was running on.
Yeah, exactly. So last week we were talking about the challenges of populism, and you wanted to bring something for us to chew on around the sort of the next iteration of that, didn't you? Talking about this sort of Pax Ecologica or Pax Ecology. How would we say it? Pax Ecology? Pax Ecologia?
Pax Ecologica, I think, yeah. This is really, I mean, it comes out of our endless question, what have you been reading? So yesterday I finished reading this PhD thesis by this Brazilian scholar, Neto Leao, who I met briefly last year and, you know, been in touch with through the sort of the Ivan Illich mafia, the sort of friends and co-conspirators and, you know, generations coming after those who worked with Illich. And I hope that it will get turned into a book. But he both does a very good job of sort of putting Illich in the middle of the conversations that are worth having about ecological crisis, let's say. But he does it with some powerful stories and some sort of powerful moves. And in one of the chapters is called To Hell with Sustainability, which is a kind of riff on a famous text of Illich's, To Hell with Good Intentions.
Well, as a recovering sustainability consultant, then I totally agree.
Yeah, I mean, Neto talks about, he basically says, look, you know, I've looked through the literature on sustainability across all of the academic fields, and the academic end of it, you know, is pretty much all centered on stuff that misses the point of the nature of the trouble we're in and how we got here. The practical stuff is more of a mix, but it's like the whole concept of sustainability or sustainable development is not going to help us, because it starts further down the line from where the trouble is actually starting from, and therefore distracts our attention from where the trouble is starting from. And so, you know, what he's saying, I mean, he's bringing back these things that Illich was writing about in the 70s in Tools for Conviviality and Energy and Equity, where Illich is saying, look, you know, the conditions of possibility for, you know, lives worth living are that we set limits. We set limits to tools. So we choose which tools we are and are not going to use within our societies, within our communities. We set limits to ownership, and we set, oh, I'm trying to think what the third one is. But anyway, so there's the set of limits. And Neto is saying, look, unless we start from there, he's like, sustainability thinking starts from the externalities. It starts from the consequences for the environment. And so then it tries to optimize our ways of living for maximum output within ecological constraints. And even when we do bring the social into view, and this is what I'd really like to talk to Neto about, actually, because like the classic example in recent times of trying to bring the social into this is donut economics, where you go, right, we have these ecological limits on the outside and we have these social, you know, minimums on the inside, and we're trying to create something within the zone between them. Whereas what Neto is saying, building on Illich, is no, actually, the social limits are also, you know, limits within which we need to operate rather than minimums above which we need to be living. And he talks about this partly in relation to, he talks about the difference between the high agreements and the low agreements, where, you know, the high agreements are the agreements that are made at COP meetings. And he's like, yeah, you know, none of the high agreements are ever going to take us into this zone where we actually choose limits. It's like the low agreements, the ones that are made at scales closer to where we live our lives, that's where it's possible to not technocratically impose, but actually as communities decide on limits that allow us a possibility of flourishing. And he, again, he sets this in relation to something that Illich wrote in the early 80s about peace, where Illich is talking about peace and the different flavors of peace, the different languages that we translate as peace from different times and places, and how they all have their particular cultural flavor to them. But Illich talks about, you know, the Pax Populi, the people's peace, the sort of vernacular peace, which, you know, at its heart is the desire to be left in peace, to be able to get on with life, versus the Pax Economica, which he sees as the kind of modern version of the Pax Romana, the sort of imperial mechanisms of control and management and bringing everything into a system which benefits the center. And Neto's like, you know, what we're looking at with what sustainability ends up meaning is a Pax Ecologica that is rebooting and taking the place of the Pax Economica, where you now have, you know, it has to have green rather than dirty technologies, but it's still the same logic at work. And I was just struck, actually, by that. I'd forgotten that Illich uses the expression the Pax Populi, the peace of the people. Mm. And I was like, ah, there's another clue to that thing we were talking about last time in terms of, you know, what does a good populism looks like, or what is the good true thing within the cauldron of stuff that often takes toxic forms that we use the language of populism to describe. And that takes us back again to this thing of the low agreements, because the example that Neto has, he did some field work on this island on the Brazilian coast, where there's this village of like 250 people, and they didn't get electricity until 2007. And in 2003, when Lula had come to power and come out with the plan to electrify the whole of Brazil, in their community, they went and visited some other villages not that far from them that had been connected up to the grid and looked at what was happening. And they were like, there's a lot of stuff that we don't like about the way that this is playing out. And so they decided that they were going to have electricity, but within limits. So they would just get a certain number of solar panels, and they would choose collectively, like, certain technologies we're not going to have. No microwaves, no hair dryers, only warm water showers in winter. And 2 hours in the day when it's possible to watch a television. And he's like, this is an example of what Illich is talking about, what I'm talking about looks like, of the low agreements and the way in which decisions that are about how we want to live together can create the conditions for, you know, if you like, a real sustainability, whilst things where we start from the logic of sustainability don't take us anywhere near there, but just leave us kind of spinning in something quite delusional in terms of the gap between, like, I was reading a great thing from Pella Thiel from the Swedish Transition Movement, where she's writing about this and saying, you know, I hear all of this talk about transitioning from fossil fuels, where it's absolutely clear that the people talking about it are not engaging with what that would really cost, what that would really mean. And I think what Neto's talking about might have some clues for how we break that open and get into the conversations we need to be having.
Well, it's as you say, I mean, the high agreements don't work. I mean, that's why a COP process that's been going for decades has only ever delivered higher emissions of carbon, you know, in spite of everything. And also, I think there's something that you've just described there which unlocks it, which is one of the reasons that COPs always fail is because they're grotesquely unfair about who shares the responsibility. And, you know, they've got these sort of cack-handed attempts to try and, not go anywhere near what contraction and convergence would actually look like, which would be equitable. But it is always like, you know, we're struggling to try and find the funds for other people to transition, or for other nations or for other contexts to transition away from fossil fuels. But as you say, that high agreement is a like-for-like replacement, which never talks about demand and never talks about limits. And, you know, when you're describing that Brazilian island, it really took me back to Egg, you know, off the coast of Scotland, which I visited a few years ago when I was sea kayaking with the outdoor philosopher Kate Rawls and her gang. We didn't kayak out to Egg, that would have been a bit ambitious, but we did take the very tiny bumpy ferry, which I remember being quite a hair-raising journey. And for those who don't know Egg, you know, it's this amazing little Inner Hebridean island, which has had, you know, a terrible sort of turbulent history of absentee landlords and being owned by some slightly eccentric characters, but eventually was bought by its inhabitants. And they've installed, obviously, a 100% renewable energy grid. And it was quite a pioneering microgrid when it was first put in. It managed to enable them to get rid of their big dirty diesel generator, which made them totally dependent on expensive imported fuel. And with a mixture of sort of wind and hydro and solar, you know, they've now got quite a kind of robust and resilient little system, but it's exactly the same. You know, it's all limited to what people can have. And so they sort of limit the flow to 5 kilowatts per household and 10 kilowatts for the businesses on the island. And it seems to work because it's like a community cap, which enables everyone to share. And they've all got little energy meters in their houses so they can see what they are collectively generating. And they've got a bit of battery storage as well. But equally, they can see what their own loading going into the system is. So it's a kind of like, it's a voluntary thing. It's like going, you should not be putting your dishwasher or your, you know, and I doubt many people on Egg have a dishwasher, but, you know, putting your washing machine on, you know, when you've also got the kettle on, and it's balancing that kind of thing. But it is about that collective community agreement of what the limit of the production is likely to be, without covering the entire island in solar panels and turbines, and matching that.
Yeah, and this is sort of Neto's hunch, is that there are actually lots and lots of examples of this around the world, but that they don't fit into the big stories that we're operating within. So I know that he's doing research now in Italy, where he's also found communities that have similarly been making kind of conscious collective decisions around what they do and don't want to have as part of their ways of living. But the other example that struck me just this morning, I was looking at Peter Lindbergh, who used to run the Stoa. He has a Substack called Less Foolish, and his latest post on that was called Unscreening. And he's got this photograph of this nice box that he and his wife have made, where at 6:30 every evening, they put their phones into these two slots in the box and put them away. And for the rest of the day, there's no phones, there's no devices. And I'm not going to pretend that we live like that just now around here in our household. But the household is the sort of the smallest unit, perhaps, at which we can make those kinds of collective agreements and practice and exercise the muscle of chosen restraint, not in the name of kind of hair shirt logic, but actually for what it makes possible. Because that's what Peter articulates really well, is that they switch their phones off and put them away because of the good things that that makes room for within their lives and within their day and within their household.
Well, I mean, and constraint breeds innovation and creativity, which I'm sure we'll come back on to later in this. Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a fascinating piece you've been reading. I mean, I've been working with the Forward Institute this week on responsible leadership. We had a kind of online residential yesterday, and I was reflecting on some of the discussions that we had there, because the big thing that we were chewing on was the aftermath of this post office Horizon scandal. And it really made me think of, you know, the humbling, because we were obviously looking at the post office thing, which people don't know, you know, it's basically there was a hugely glitchy IT system, which basically ended up accusing, incriminating and indeed jailing, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of sub-postmasters across the UK, because it was making mistakes in the accounting and then accusing them of theft. And indeed, it led to people committing suicide, you know, people's lives being absolutely broken and destroyed. And it went on for years. You know, I'm an avid reader of Private Eye, and I was following the story since, you know, 2010 or 2011. So, you know, now it's broken through into sort of the mainstream public consciousness because of a ITV dramatization called, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. But from a responsible leadership perspective, what is absolutely horrifying when you dig into it is this systemic denial of what was going on. And indeed, you know, the active dishonesty, which is what seems to be now unfolding, of people knowing that there were real problems here, but papering over the cracks, and indeed doubling down every time they were given an opportunity, rather than hold the hands up and do what humility would suggest we should do, which is acknowledge a very, very serious mistake, which is destroying lives, and hold your hands up and be accountable, and to say, you know, an unequivocal apology, saying this is a fuck up, and then take the right action. And it doesn't have to be knee jerk, but it just seems to be this sorry saga that went on for years of everyone ducking that opportunity for what we might call humble, responsible leadership. And it really struck me. We were having a discussion in my little group, and I sort of joked, you know, this is why I co-host a podcast called The Great Humbling, which is now on its fifth series, because, you know, humility matters. And one of my group is a former professional rugby player, and he was saying, he shared a story of an interesting example. He said, there is a Premiership rugby club that shall remain nameless, you know, that had its values around the top of the stadium in 15-foot letters, one of which is humility. So literally got humility in 15-foot letters above the top of the grandstand, which I really liked. It's like, and it's the
grandstanding humility.
Exactly. And it's like, and it's one of those moments you go, do we really have to tell people to be humble? It's like having to tell people to be kind. Why do we need constantly reminding that kindness and humility, you know, need to be on the top of your list rather than buried somewhere near the bottom?
I mean, it's just a horror show, the post office story, and in so many ways, and it does seem like part of it is a kind of sort of grim parable of the disastrous consequences of treating systemic reality as all that is real, or as the most trustworthy representation of the world.
Yeah,
because one of the things that's come to the surface in this is that legally the burden of proof when it comes to humans lies on the person making the accusation. The burden of proof when it comes to the computer systems is that the law assumes, unless you prove that there's something wrong with it, that what a computer system is saying is right, yeah, and correct and accurate.
Yeah.
And you've had experts coming forward going, unless we change this, then you're going to get more and other versions of this horror show playing out. But it just is very interesting to me, the assumption that computers are more trustworthy than people, that's not just part of the organizational culture that allowed this horror show to happen, but actually part of the structure of law as it has emerged as computers have become part of our lives. And I was sent the other day by a friend of mine, an art historian, Giacomo. He sent me a quote which he translated from a book by a man called Giuseppe Longo. And the book is only available in French at the moment, but the title of it is Prometheus's Nightmare. And the last line of this passage that he translated for me, I love. And it goes like this: "The abundance of the unpredictable in the world tells us the poverty of the calculable fragment of the world." The abundance of the unpredictable in the world tells us the poverty of the calculable fragment of the world. There is so much more to reality than the part of it that can be calculated and made predictable. And yet that's very threatening to the logic of the systems around which we've built so much of our lives and on which we are genuinely so dependent in the world that we're starting from here and now.
I mean, that notion of the poverty of the calculable fragment of the world is really powerful. It's not a world away from the other thing that I've been reading, which, you know, following ploughing through the KLF with such joy, I've picked up John Higgs's book, William Blake Versus the World, which, you know, is equally magnificent in its own way. And actually, he opens that book with a quote from the French poet Paul Éluard. He said, "Yeah, there's certainly another world, but it is in this one."
Mm.
You know, it's beyond that, the poor calculable fragment, as Giuseppe was saying. And, you know, for Blake, and from sort of Blake's perspective, it was genuinely visionary, you know, this other world contained within ours. And even though he was sort of living in this incredibly stoic poverty, ironically just near where the Savoy Hotel currently stands on the Strand, but obviously would have been a rather basic garret at the time. And, you know, I think that sort of visionary notion is best encapsulated in some lines from Jerusalem, which is, I give you the end of a golden string, only wind it into a ball, it will lead you in at heaven's gate, built in Jerusalem's wall. And you know how in this podcast, you know, we used to dig in a lot to the etymology. And it's really interesting, like the etymology of vision comes from that Middle English sense of supernatural apparition. And we use it to refer to Blake, but it's funny how it's been reduced in terms of the power of its meaning. And it's now downgraded to like regular everyday sight, you know, hence you have a high street optician called Vision Express, which is not offering you a fast track to supernatural apparitions, but it's offering you glasses and contact lenses. And, you know, and what I love about what John Higgs is doing in the book is helping me, I think, and the reader to understand and to break down some of that ineffability, you know, the hard to describe aspects of Blake's vision and what lies beyond. Because, I mean, clearly why William Blake is so special is because of his creative skill, to be able to make representations of what he was seeing. And, you know, he talks very passionately about his double vision, which was obviously the outward eye, the stuff he saw, but then the stuff that he saw in his heart, and the stuff that was his inward eye, the stuff that was manifesting in his own mind. And he talks, you know, again, referring back to your Giuseppe Longo quote, he talks about, you know, the single vision, you know, of that poverty of the calculable fragment as Newton's sleep, you know, that kind of reductionist material notion. And then, you know, again, we know Higgs is really good at this kind of articulation of what is going on. But then he talks about Blake's threefold vision, you know, not just this double vision, but this threefold vision, which brings in an ephemeral state of grace, which is the feeling he had when he combined that inward and outward vision. And then even a fourfold vision, which is where it became, you know, a connection to the sublime, you know, the truly noetic eternity. And what I think is so important, and what's really been resonating with me, is how Blake's creative imagination was so much about the annihilation of the self, you know, the removal of the ego, the brain being essentially an entropy control organ that needs to be liberated. And everything about our modern cultural programming and training is about entropy control and not allowing these, you know, wild flights of fantasy and imagination. And I think we've talked about this briefly when we were talking about Let's Do Shrooms, where we were talking about the role of the default mode network, you know, and the control system in the brain, which stops different parts of the brain talking to each other. Now, we know that it's highly unlikely that Blake was, you know, undergoing shamanic psychedelic practices, because they weren't big in London at the time when he was living. And if someone ate some argot mold or mushrooms, it was probably been put down to some other type of madness rather than some kind of ritual practice. But, you know, what Higgs cites is this US neurobiologist, Dean Buonamano, get that right, who said the brain is an illusion factory. And even Nietzsche said, you know, we are much more the artists than we realize in terms of creating the world around us. And there's this wonderful quote that he brings in from Blake himself. We say, "In your bosom, you bear your heaven and earth and all you behold. Though it appears without, it is within in your imagination. What you experience as a world is created in your mind." And we've touched on this thread, you know, several times in our discussions. And it made me dredge up something from Anais Nin, who said, you know, we do not see the world as it is. We see it as we are. And, you know, I'm only about a third of the way through the book, but I am loving the kind of potential stretching exploration of these types of ideas, because ultimately, you know, where Blake gets to and where Higgs sort of reference him, he said, "Art is not a pleasing diversion or some form of mild entertainment. It is actually the only way to redemption and to redemption for the world." And you've referred to the Inklings, haven't you, before, you know, Tolkien, Lewis and the philosopher Owen Barfield. Because he actually talked about a need for the responsibility of the imagination because of the way that imagination can manifest into the world, because of the way ideas can leak out of the brain and then become real. This was all really resonant for me because I've been involved, you know, with this hard art group convened by Brian Eno. We're putting on our first big event because this is the whole notion of what hard art is. You know, it's hard and it's necessary, but it is probably the only way to redemption. It's these cultural interventions, these cultural ideas, and bringing that creativity to work on the stuff that really matters, which what we're doing in Manchester at the end of February is going to be very much around what we're slightly Riley calling the fate of Britain, but as in a village fate. So deliberate pun intended. But it is going to be a, you know, a potent, creative and playful, politicized, in a way, exploration of what it means to be actively and creatively engaged in the climate crisis and the crisis of democracy. And what are the radical ways of participation, perhaps some of those low agreements that you were talking about, that might actually come to the fore.
It's really exciting to me because I feel like there is a kind of a coming to fruit of some seeds that we were sowing with Dark Mountain in this, because, you know, for a long time now, in the circles that you and I have moved in parts of our life and work, you hear people appeal quite easily to the imagination and, like, you know, you've probably heard Martin Shaw be grumpy about this. People go, oh, yeah, what we need is a new story, as if that's something kind of it's almost like even when there is a recognition that imagination, art, creativity might be something more than just the kind of diversion or the form of entertainment, still there is a kind of an easiness, a cheapness, if you like, to the way that it's asked to show up. Mm. And that's what I've been kind of bashing my head against for years, or kind of articulating in different places, including in At Work in the Ruins, that no, there is something costly and problematic and troubling about the way that art shows up. And it's not that you're wrong that it has an important role to play. It's just that it's not a tool, because a tool is something you can pick up, and you pick up one end of it and you know what the other end of it is going to do. You know, I sometimes have talked about the weak power of art, that it doesn't have that kind of strong instrumental power that a tool has. You can't predict what's going to happen as a consequence of it. But that precisely, you know, in that weak power lies its costliness, the fact that it's going to require you to change. It's going to require you to have your assumptions turned upside down. And I feel like, you know, what you and, you know, Brian and all sorts of other good people have been quietly brewing away, that's finally emerging into public view as the Hard Art Collective, to me, is very exciting because of the range of people that it's bringing together, and that it's, you know, it's got this language and this not just language, but a kind of deeply felt sense of costliness, of difficulty, rather than of the kind of the well-intentioned trying to do good that paves the way to hell, as Illich would tell us. So I love the title, The Fate of Britain. I can't wait to see how this, I can't wait to follow the fate of Britain.
Well, I think I said it before, but, you know, Brian's motivation in convening the group was like, I know all these amazing people. Why don't they all know each other? And why aren't they working and collaborating together? And it is exactly as you say, the diversity, but also the patience. You know, we've been working together for well over a year now. And I think it would have been, you know, in a kind of fidgety way, it would have been very easy to go, well, I've been along to some hard art sessions, you know, but where's this all going? And I think what has been wonderful, and hopefully will continue to be wonderful, is people's preparedness to show up and do the time. And be confident that if we commit to that, then what emerges will be far more powerful and effective because we've committed the time, you know, the patience, we've waited for it to show up. You know, it's not been like, oh right, you know, we had a 3-hour workshop and these are the 4 outputs that we're going to implement over the next 2 months, and boom, and you're doing this and I'm doing that. And it's not been like that at all, and I think that's its real strength.
So as we bring this episode into land, there's still something with me from Neto's taking up of Illich's language of the Pax Populi and the peace of the people. And it's partly that it just speaks to this longing that is so evidently around at this moment, a longing for a peace that is hard to imagine in lots of parts of the world. And I mean, Jonathan Rowson's been writing about this, and he's like, we need to reimagine peace for the 21st century, because it's not just, you know, peace between nations much as that is to be longed for, but it's a kind of peace in our relation to the world itself, and our way of inhabiting the world. And I did read a piece of Jonathan's this week that's part of a series he's been writing on that, where he was quoting a character from one of the Star Wars movies that I'm afraid I haven't seen. A character called Jyn Erso. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. But the line was good, and the line goes like this. "They've no idea we're coming. They've no reason to expect us. If we can make it to the ground, we'll take the next chance, and the next, on and on, until we win or the chances are spent." And Jonathan was connecting this to a line that's attributed to Francis of Assisi. "If at first you do what is necessary, and then do what is possible, soon you find you're achieving the impossible." And I think that this might be part of the character of the low agreements, part of the way of working with that, you know, strange patience, even in the face of an evident urgency that you describe in the Hard Art Collective, and part of what characterises the Pax Populi rather than the kind of the peace that is imposed and enforced from above, is that it involves the kind of the one step in front of the other, not trying to, you know, act on the basis of having calculated the probability of success, but acting anyway, despite the difficulty of imagining what success would actually look like, because all you're asked to do is show up to do, you know, the next thing and then the next thing, what's necessary and what's possible, and maybe, you know, with faith, something that seems impossible begins to emerge from that willingness to show up patiently.
Yeah, I mean, that's how the community of Egg owned and powered their own island. You know, it's like the impossible dream.
Right.
Yeah, when we were discussing the humility at the post office, or lack of, with the Forward Institute crew, there's another colleague of mine from there who always quotes Arthur Ashe, you know, the American, black American tennis player, who said, you know, start where you are, use what you have, do what you can.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We're grateful for all the messages we get from listeners and the other ways you support us, sharing these episodes, spreading the word, and rating them on iTunes and elsewhere. To explore further along the paths we walk in these conversations, subscribe to my Substack, Writing Home, and check out the online series At a School Called Home. You can also find us on Facebook as The Great Humbling, and Ed is at Frucool on the platform formerly known as Twitter. The Great Humbling is produced by David Benjamin Blower, and the title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions.